Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Although most Americans support the death penalty in theory, death sentences in America have declined more than 60% since 1996, and attitudes towards execution are changing. We'll find out why. Let's take note with Frank Baumgartner and Amber Boydston, co-authors with Susanna DeBoeuf of The Decline of the Death Penalty and The Discovery of Innocence. The book is published by Cambridge Press. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
It's nice to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your research project, which resulted in this book.
Well, I can start. We began about 5 years ago when I got a phone call from a lobbyist in Washington who said that he was interested in talking about reframing a public policy issue, and he knew that I had done some work on how issues get framed or described in public. And I said, well, what's the issue and what's the frame that you're trying to promote? And he said, well, the issue is the death penalty, and the frame is that it's a government program run by bureaucrats, and it's prone to cost overruns, inefficiencies, and mistakes. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and I agreed to go talk and meet with his organization. And we started the project that way, literally with a phone call.
And the death penalty wasn't something particularly high on your list of interests or concerns, but I think that changed once you got into this.
Well, I had never studied it. I had written about other public policies in the past, and it's a compelling story. It's a very interesting, obviously important, and extremely distressing when you read about it, the things that have happened to people over the years in the criminal justice system. The error rate is surprising, and I don't have an axe to grind. I just started this project on this phone call, but it's been really, very, well, distressing.
And I think eye-opening. You, Amber, were...
A first-year graduate student when the project started, yeah. So I jumped on board right away, and it's funded my entire graduate career.
So you pored over coverage of capital punishment that appeared in the New York Times from 1960 to the year 2005. Give us an idea of what you saw in the newspaper.
That's right. A fellow student, Cheryl Feely, herself now a law student in D.C., she and I read and coded about 3,500 New York Times articles on the death penalty. And it was astonishing, as someone like Frank, who had never personally been interested in the issue, but now for the purposes of research was delving into it. It was extraordinary the range of emotions that we would take reading these articles. We would read article after article about horrific crimes that make you yearn for some system of justice and consequence. And then you would read articles about the proclivity of the system to error and to wrongful conviction, and it was tough not to walk away from those articles and feel like the system is broken in some fundamental way that predates the media coverage of it.
And what you found out, if I'm correct, is that your attitudes changed, and so did the public's, that this coverage did have some influence on the debate, on the discussions that we have about capital punishment.
That's right. We showed statistically that not only has national media coverage, media framing of the debate, had a dramatic impact on public support, macro public support, but also on the policy itself, on the number of human beings sentenced to death each year.
Thurgood Marshall once said, quote, "The more people learned about the death penalty, the more they'd be against it." And prior to this book, I'm wondering what your views were, Dr. Baumgartner, on the death penalty.
Well, different people have different philosophical approaches to it, and it's really based on their moral sense and often from their religious background. And I was raised in a family where we didn't believe in the death penalty. It was never an option. And also in a state, like many states in the United States, that doesn't have the death penalty. The geographical dispersion of the death penalty is unbelievably distinct. And here in Pennsylvania, there's only been three executions since the 1970s. And in Texas, there's been almost 400. And in many states, there's been fewer than three. And in Michigan, where I come from, the death penalty has never been allowed as long as it's been a state since the 1800s. So I was personally opposed, but not particularly involved in the issue, not involved in the issue whatsoever. The thing that was remarkable, though, about this discovery of innocence, as we call it, is Americans have not changed their moral views on the debate whatsoever. We've looked at the survey evidence in great detail, and most people believe in the Old Testament of the Bible. It's very straightforward, and there no amount of arguing is going to get somebody to stop believing in a certain religious perspective and adopt another moral perspective on the death penalty, just like abortion or some other debates. What's happened in this debate is the way of discussing the death penalty was the moral way of discussing it, whether it was appropriate to have the ultimate punishment. The new way that started to arise in the 1980s and reached a crescendo in around the year 2000 throughout the late 1990s and beyond is that it's a bureaucratic program just like any other government program. And if you look at it in some detail, you find out that it costs an awful lot. It makes a certain number of errors. And, of course, in this case, an error is irretrievable and tragic. And it has a lot of downsides that that are hidden away in the simple moralistic perspective on the issue. So that was really astounding to us. The other part that's astounding is the proclivity to error is nothing new. It's always been there. And we can point to examples back in the 1830s when people would be convicted of a murder, but in fact, the murder had never occurred, and the proof of that was when the supposed victim of the murder came to watch the hanging. So it doesn't necessarily take DNA to demonstrate that there was a mistake in the system.
So what's changed then, you're saying, is the framing of the issue.
That's exactly right. In fact, just to back up Frank's point, there have been 124 exonerations from death row since the 1970s, and of those, only 15, I think, have been the result of DNA evidence. So the DNA phenomenon has certainly helped to bring a buzz to the innocence frame in recent years, but it really has been a shift in attention, not a shift in the underlying facts.
You talked about errors. They were present in the past and they're present currently. What are the major factors that go into wrongful convictions?
Oh, you name it. It's in there. Everything from inaccurate eyewitness testimony to wrongful behavior by the prosecuting attorney, what they call dry labbing, which is actually creating or falsifying evidence within the DNA lab.
If you think about it, no one is subject to the death penalty unless a truly horrific crime has been committed. So there's a lot of emotion in these criminal proceedings, and there's a great desire to find somebody and to hold somebody responsible. And our justice system is an adversarial justice system. So it's two sides fighting. One thing I didn't know before doing this project, but which makes sense, is that nobody hires their own attorney for a criminal defense. It costs too much money. So everybody relies, all the death row inmates rely on the public defender's office. And adequate funding for public defenders is not a popular political item. So there's a lot of politics in this and a lot of conflict and I would say a lot of hatred, a lot of emotion in the criminal justice system. You know, it's a horrific crime that has been committed at some point in every one of these cases.
If you look at the number of executions in the United States over the last two decades, and executions peaked, I think, in about 1999, a couple of things really pop out. And the first is that southern states have nearly a monopoly on executions. You mentioned Texas just a moment ago. And secondly, minorities receive the death penalty disproportionately to whites. Talk a little bit about the connection between those two things and how it's affecting the debate.
Well, one is there was an old death penalty in the United States up until the Supreme Court rendered it unconstitutional in 1972. And the peak application of the death penalty in the U.S. actually was in 1935. And from the period of World War II until the 1960s, there was less and less application of the death penalty nationwide. Until 1968, there was not a single execution, and there were no executions from the 60s into the 70s. The modern death penalty, when it reemerged after 1976, was much more geographically distinct. The northern states have never applied it as often as the southern states, but in the modern era, it's been increasingly geographically isolated. That may be one thing that would potentially lead the Supreme Court to render it unconstitutional. If only a few states do it, that will be of constitutional import. The racial side of the death penalty, of course, is, like other aspects of the criminal justice system, striking to an outsider. When you see the statistics, they're remarkable. And actually, the most remarkable is the race of the victim rather than the race of the defendant is what's most striking.
Just look at the cover of your book, and you see predominantly black faces on the cover of your book. And these are people who have been exonerated.
Yeah, these are all people that have been exonerated, and they come in all races and creeds, though, but it's a huge overrepresentation of people of color in the prison system in general, but also, of course, those on death row.
Now, you said a moment ago that our moral background and our religious backgrounds haven't changed. What has changed, though, is the tone and tenor of the debate about capital punishment. I'm wondering about that New York Times coverage. What was the tone and tenor of that coverage that you looked at, Amber?
Well, it changed over time, and that's exactly what we saw. And as we traced the tone and tenor of the coverage over time, we saw it map on in really interesting and important ways to the shifting degrees of public support for the death penalty. So in the 1960s and 70s and up through the 80s and early 90s, it was fundamentally framed as a moral issue or as a constitutional one. And it was only in the late 1990s that all of a sudden this wave of media coverage centered around the concept that in a system run by bureaucrats, mistakes could happen. And that really took fire.
We looked at the New York Times compared to a group of 10 other major newspapers, including the Houston Chronicle as well. So it's not peculiar to a particular journalistic bias of a liberal elite Eastern newspaper.
That's right.
In a word, what does all this mean, do you think, for the future of the death penalty or capital punishment in this country?
It's a remarkable reversal. It's one of the policies that Americans feel most comfortable with, and yet it's disappearing fast. And it may well disappear permanently.
Our guests have been Dr. Frank Baumgartner, who is the Miller Levine Professor of Political Science at Penn State, and Amber Boydston, a Penn State graduate student. The two are co-authors with Susanna DeBoeuf of The Decline of the Death Penalty and The Discovery of Innocence. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Lawmakers in our neighbor state of New Jersey voted 44-36 in December to abolish the death penalty. Meanwhile, this past October, the American Bar Association released a study criticizing Pennsylvania's death penalty system. In the next part of our program, Cynthia Berger talks with Andrew Susko, president of the Pennsylvania Bar Association.
Andrew Susko, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Capital punishment in Pennsylvania dates to pre-revolutionary days. I understand the punishment even for crimes like robbery used to be death by hanging. So start us out by bringing us up to date for folks who might not be sure. In Pennsylvania today, what crime could have the death penalty as a consequence?
Yes, in around 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Furman versus Georgia, struck down the death penalty law in that state. And in response, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court struck down the Pennsylvania death penalty statute also in 1972. And the legislature responded by limiting the death penalty to cases of first-degree murder where there is an intention to kill.
So that's the only case?
Yes, that's correct.
Where the death penalty could be a consequence. And how's that sentence carried out? I know the death sentence is carried out in different ways in different states.
Yes, in Pennsylvania, beginning in 1990, lethal injection became the way the death penalty is administered. Before that, the electric chair was the means of carrying out capital punishment in the state.
And here in Pennsylvania, that happens in our listen area at the State Correctional Institution in Rockview. That's the one place where that happens.
Yeah, that's correct. That's by state statute.
And one of the reasons for bringing you in to chat today, as we said a few moments ago, is that our neighbor state, New Jersey, abolished its death penalty pretty recently in December. So that, give us a score, that leaves how many states besides Pennsylvania that still allow capital punishment?
Yeah, 38 states currently have a death penalty. Three states have declared a moratorium or recently have done away with the death penalty, including New Jersey. The other two states that declared a moratorium were Illinois and Maryland. There are 38 states currently that have the death penalty.
So the majority of states still have the death penalty, and I guess, in fact, a pretty recent poll by the Pew Research Center shows the majority of respondents, I think it was 62%, support the death penalty. So that seems to be the majority of opinion in America.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting to read in news reports about the New Jersey decision that abolishment was as much a practical decision as it was a moral decision. People are concerned that innocent people should not be executed, but it's also really expensive to keep a prisoner on death row.
Right, and most people are familiar with the studies that reflect when you actually cost out the administration of the death penalty, it takes up more resources to go through that process and have an inmate executed by lethal injection than it does to simply imprison them for life.
What do you know about wrongful executions? There is a movement to prevent innocent people from being executed. What do you know about the rate at which people might be wrongfully executed?
Yeah, currently there are 3,300 individuals on death row nationwide, and since the death penalty was reinstituted in and around 1974, there have been 199 exonerations, including six in Pennsylvania. And since that time, only three executions in Pennsylvania. So the fact that, for example, DNA evidence now is available and is a powerful tool in the courtroom that wasn't really in existence even a generation ago, has given defense lawyers the tools to more carefully challenge the guilt of their client. And one of the six that were exonerated was based on DNA evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really been an amazing development in evidence. Opponents of the death penalty often argue there's no evidence that the death penalty deters criminals, keeps them from carrying out their crimes. Those who advocate for the death penalty, what are the arguments in favor of keeping it in our system?
Well, I think the organized bar's principal focus, of course, is having what is the law, and the death penalty is part of Pennsylvania law, administered fairly and accurately. As to the reasons for the punishment, you've spoken earlier that the majority of the citizens support that. Whether that's as a form of punishment for the crime or deterring effect on future crimes being committed, there are a host of studies on the subject, and there's not universal agreement as to whether there is a deterrent effect, but both punishment and deterrence are the principal reasons cited.
Well, just this past October, the American Bar Association put out a report criticizing Pennsylvania's death penalty system. I want to talk with you about the specifics of that report, but before we do, it's probably pertinent to talk about why the ABA decided to take a look at Pennsylvania. I think it's important to say it's not that they're singling Pennsylvania out. It's part of a larger study. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the American Bar Association in 1997 actually called for a moratorium on the use of the death penalty. And in Pennsylvania, our own organization, the Pennsylvania Bar Association, similarly called for a moratorium on the death penalty. And that essentially can be described for three reasons. One,
it's not that they're opposed to the death penalty. We need to say that, right?
Yes, correct. Both the ABA and the Pennsylvania Bar have not taken the position that they're opposed to the death penalty. It's all about assuring that when the ultimate penalty is sought under the criminal law and actually utilized, that there be fairness and accuracy in the administration of the death penalty. And as I was saying, the principal areas of concern are adequacy of defense counsel resources, justice system shortcomings, according to the American Bar's report, and then making sure that there's racial fairness in the administration of the death penalty. So in those three areas, adequacy of resources, justice system shortcomings, and racial fairness, the ABA examined and concluded that further work needs to be done in Pennsylvania to assure a fair and accurate death penalty system.
So the ABA has already assessed a number of other states, Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Tennessee. How were those states chosen and how is Pennsylvania chosen?
The ABA called, as I said, for a moratorium in 1997, and then in furtherance of that, obtained funding on an international basis to pilot states, and essentially chose states where, A, there was a death penalty, and B, where there either had been substantial numbers of executions in the past, or there were a number of inmates on death row. In Pennsylvania, for example, currently there are 228 inmates on death row.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this study weighed in on 12 points having to do with how a death penalty case is handled. We don't have time to talk about all of them, but let's talk with some of the main shortcomings, and let's start with racial disparities in sentencing, if you could address that.
Yeah, I think that perhaps is the most challenging and complex area. Basically, the concern is that prosecutors are using race as a significant factor in determining whether to seek the death penalty, and jurors are prone to use race also as a factor in determining whether they are going to find for the death penalty in a given case. And there are a number of studies out there that suggest that there is racial bias within the system. That racial bias, however, under the law alone, is not a basis to overturn a conviction.
Juror confusion is also another issue. People don't understand that life without parole, that's what it really means.
Yeah, and that's in the area of justice system improvements. One of the areas the ABA focuses on is the area of whether the juries actually understand the instructions. And surveys indicate that over 95% of the jurors responded they did not understand at least some part of the court's instruction, including things like that if they don't find for the death penalty, that the other alternative typically is life without the possibility of parole. And they also often begin to deliberate on the issue of sentencing before the sentencing hearing actually occurs. In Pennsylvania, it's divided into both the trial on guilt and then a trial on sentencing. So you're correct. There is the issue of whether juries really understand fully their instructions. Another recommendation is that jurors be given those instructions in writing.
Now, there currently is some legislation pending addressing these death penalty shortcomings in the Pennsylvania legislature. Tell us about that.
Well, most significant, and the Pennsylvania Bar has long supported a capital case representation resource center. And what that would do, and that goes to the area of defense resources, making sure that there are adequate defense counsel standards. These cases are extremely complicated, long, arduous cases that require significant expertise. And so a capital resource center that is funded by the state would go a long way in assuring that we are executing and administering the death penalty only against people who actually were guilty of the crime.
I guess a lot of defendants, death row inmates, don't have access to experts. They don't have good lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue of resources, and a number of state bar associations across the country have looked at the issue of disparity between prosecutorial resources and defense resources. The bottom line is that there needs to be rough equivalency or parity once in the death penalty administration phase with regard to experts and investigators to determine whether this ultimate penalty should be administered.
Well, I wish we could talk more on such an important topic, but I'm afraid we're out of time. Andrew Sesko, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Andrew Sesko is president of the Pennsylvania Bar Association and a practicing lawyer in Center City, Philadelphia. For Take Note, I'm Cynthia Berger.
Podcasts of this program are available at WPSU.org. This has been a production of Penn State Public Broadcasting.